On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Today is the first day of the new fiscal year for the city of Baltimore. The city council beat their June 30th deadline to approve a budget by 10 days this year, but not without considerable acrimony. City Council President Jack Young and Budget Committee Chairwoman Helen Holton threatened to shut down city government over an argument with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake about funding for youth programs. Helen Holton joins me, along with Councilman Brandon Scott, to talk about the council, the mayor, and the money. Plus, our movie mavens, Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post, offer some alternatives to the big Hollywood blockbusters that are unleashed every season around the 4th of July. We'll talk about a few documentaries you may be interested in checking out instead. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us and hope you are looking forward to a great holiday weekend. Today is the first day of the new fiscal year for the city of Baltimore. The city charter requires that the city council approve a budget no later than yesterday. Well, they met that deadline with about 10 days to spare this time around. But as of a couple of weeks ago, the specter of a city government shutdown was real. The council and Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake were deadlocked for weeks over funding for youth programs. City Council President Jack Young and Budget Committee Chairwoman Helen Holton threatened to shut down unless $4.2 million was restored to the budget for those programs. The mayor eventually agreed to put that money back in the budget, but only after making cuts to things like the Pratt Library, bridge repairs, and anti-litter programs. We begin this morning with Helen Holton, who represents the 8th District, and Brandon Scott, the city councilman from the 2nd District, who also serves on the Budget and Appropriations Committee. Good morning to you both, and happy 4th.
Good morning, Tom. Same to you.
So, Ms. Holton, you were chuckling when I said that you and President Young threatened a shutdown of the city. Do you think that's an inaccurate characterization?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought it up, because this is an opportunity to clarify what the charter says.
That's why you're here.
The charter says that the city council must enact a budget within 5 days of the end of the fiscal year. So June 25th was our deadline day. Had we not done anything, then the budget presented to us, the ordinance of estimates, would have become the budget for the fiscal year. What the sticking point was, and our request was for $5 million, not 4.2. 4.2 is the number that stuck in everybody's mind from last year.
Because that's what was spent last year.
Right? Well, that's what was invested last year that was not a part of the budget, but came along through transfers, internal transfers. And so the budget that we passed is the same budget that was presented to us. What we did was we negotiated some transfers to get the $4.2 million to spare some very worthy projects, programs that provide after school, before school, out of school time, structured, safe environments for more than 3,000 children in our city.
Folks who've been paying attention to City Hall for a long time say that this particular go-round with the budget was one of the most acrimonious, if not the most acrimonious, contentious negotiation and discussion that anybody can remember. There seems to be a great deal of distrust between the council and the mayor. Would you characterize it in that way?
I don't know if I would use the word distrust, but I would certainly use the word of lack of compromise and cooperation to work together towards a common good. Honest minds can agree to differ, but I think at the end of the day, and one of the things I said, is that youth investment is public safety. We spend in excess of $483 million that goes to the police department. What we were looking for, and I'm not going to count the school system's budget because our school system is woefully underfunded, but
and has its own separate
and
budget.
And has its own separate budget. So $483 million versus $5 million out of a $1.7 plus billion general fund operating budget. Crumbs on the table.
Brandon Scott, why is it that folks think, whether rightfully or wrongfully, that Council President Young and Ms. Holton and some others were saying, okay, if the mayor doesn't come around and restore this money, be it 4.2 or 5 million, we're going to shut the government down. That was the phrase, that was the term of art people were using.
Quite simply, Tom, that's a creation of your friends of the media. We often know that whatever is put out in the media is what becomes reality, even if it isn't reality. And I know that immediately when it started to happen, the council president made a point to remind all the council members and anybody that would listen that that's just not possible. And it's unfortunate that it got put out there that way, because it makes it look like, you know, we're having this DC Congress type argument and we're going to hurt people's jobs and services by not showing up to work and not allowing people to work, which was not true. Like the councilwoman said, we just wanted the money for the after school and the other programs. That was all.
So had an impasse not been gotten through with this $4.2 or $5 million, the government would not have shut down.
No, sir.
The government, the budget from last year, or the budget that had been submitted, would have become the law of the land.
No, not so. We had identified $5.1 million in cuts that we were going to make to the mayor's budget if we were not able to reach some sort of compromise. But the point was, even in identifying those areas to propose as cuts to the budget, we saw them as opportunities to fund the $4.25 million we were looking for on behalf of our children.
There are still some programs that Council President Young, for example, mentioned, Experience Corps, Cooperative Extension, the Waverly and Northwood before and after care centers that are not funded
in this
current budget.
They are now. They're not in the budget. If you read the budget
book,
you will not find them, but that is part of what we negotiated.
Through the transfers.
And so those programs were made whole through transfers negotiated with the administration.
So everything that you were looking for, you and Council President and others who agree with your position, has been achieved in the current budget that was passed?
It's not in the budget. It was a compromise, and it was not at 100% of what our request was. But it was a substantial, you know, it was a significant portion of what we requested. So there are a few programs that will probably suffer as a result of us not being able to fulfill, as you were saying, the current level of service. So that will have to be reduced because of the funding we did get.
Helen Holton represents the 8th District on the Baltimore City Council. Brandon Scott represents the 2nd District. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Brandon Scott, you have been an advocate, as has Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, to sell 4 of the 17 city parking garages that the city currently owns to generate revenue to fund programs like this. Council President Young has not allowed a vote on that. Why not? Do you think there is a chance now, given that this particular impasse seems to have been averted, that this is something that people will at least get a chance to talk thoroughly about and consider?
Well, Tom, quite frankly, for me, it's never been about one way or another. I've been infamously known for making both the council president and the mayor mad with me by saying that they need to just agree to allow us to see which way is better to fund this rec plan, whether it be the council president's way or the mayor's way. I really don't care. I just really want us to be able to. Yesterday, my childhood rec center, CC Jackson in Park Heights, haven't even had to see it yet, was reopened and renovated. They in Clifton Park, they added a gym to an already new rec center in Rita Church. And I just want children across the city to be able to do that. I could care less how we get there. The average citizen doesn't care how we get there, whether we lease a garage or sell it. I personally think that we should consider both. I think that selling may get more money. I think that in a few years when we can get rid of a hotel, the city should get out of the hotel business and do things like that. I think that we should also make people charge people to ride on the circulator. We shouldn't operate a free bus for tourists in the city where citizens don't have the same access. There's so many things that we can do to get this plan passed. I don't care. I am not about myself. I am not about my way being the right way or the no way or the highway. I don't care about people's personal feelings when it comes to the children. I just want to see it done.
Yeah, and the mayor is on record, Helen Holton, of being very much against making the circulator a fared, you know, a charged bus. The whole idea of it is to make it free and have that access to
tourists. Well, it's not free. You can't operate a free bus. It doesn't. It costs somebody.
It costs
something.
Yeah.
And the the notion about not charging riders a fee has to do with state grant money. But the reality is the Parking Enterprise Fund, which is an enterprise fund that dumps millions of dollars into the city's coffers every year from other parking revenue we get, could easily be set aside for the very purpose of the circulator versus other operating expenses that the city chooses to use that money for. So to say that we must have a parking tax in order to fund the circulator, as Brandon talked about with recreation, is the same scenario. That's not the only way to get it done. In 2013, we increased the parking tax. We entered into an agreement as legislators saying we would not entertain an increase to the parking tax before 2020. According to my watch, it's only 2016.
And that got thoroughly entertained this time around, didn't it?
I think
there will be an increase in the parking tax under the current budget. No.
That's a separate piece of legislation.
Okay.
And I think that we also, historically, the Department of Transportation has said that you can't charge for the circulator because you just can't do it. Well, actually, our neighbors to the south in D.C. who fund their circulator almost the exact same way, they have been charging for years for their circulator, and no one stopped riding it. No one says, oh, this is so awful. This is what they do.
When we talk about things being fully funded or not fully funded, one of the places that got a big cut is the Pratt Library. I mean, that it appears that the initial budget, see, now you're so exasperated with me because I'm telling you what folks are thinking. Mm-hmm. And you know as well as I do that that's what's happening. But, you know, $100,000 less for the Pratt Library, talk about youth programs. These are programs that directly affect
it. What the
$100,000 in the Pratt Library budget, what we were told that is written in the budget was that it was for materials and supplies. Had it said something differently, we would have never targeted and said that, wait, the Pratt Library has a surplus of over $1 million. So $100,000 for 1 year is not going to shut down the Pratt Library.
It's not going to impact hours of services.
That's right.
And we also have to remember that in the future years, the state has dedicated more money to
keeping
our Pratt Libraries
open
longer.
12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right. Well, this is a big topic, and we're going to have you back at some point and some other folks to talk about the budget. The budget is so confusing. Our producer, Bridget Armstrong, and I spent a lot of time yesterday trying to divine what this whole thing means, and we couldn't do it. So I'm the first to admit that I don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to the city budget, but it is such an important central tenet of how we govern our city. So I appreciate you all coming in this morning. Have a wonderful holiday. Thanks
so much.
Thank you.
Helen Holton has represented the 8th District on the Baltimore City Council for more than 20 years. She serves as the chair of the Budget and Appropriations Committee, and she'll retire at the end of her term in December. Brandon Scott represents the 2nd District and also serves on the Budget and Appropriations Committee. We've got a link to more information about the city budget on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, the Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's the first Friday of the month, and that means we have convened the movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Ann Horn, today to talk about movies coming up for the summer. It's the blockbuster weekend. So, Jed, good to see you. How you doing?
Good to see you. Thanks.
Excited about your 4th of July weekend?
I am.
You got fireworks in the future?
I think we do, yeah.
Good. And Ann, how about you?
Yes, good.
R&R. You're going to be lighting things?
I might light a sparkler.
There you go. Throw it off the roof. Do something festive.
Just hold it.
Just hold it.
Behold.
Oh.
Yes.
All right. But this is, of course, the weekend that all the big summer blockbusters get released. By the way, how did the term blockbuster come to be in movies? Because, you know, in real estate, blockbusting is a terrible thing.
That's a good point. It's all about
racism and kicking people out of neighborhoods and, you know, convincing people that the values in their neighborhood are going to go down if, you know, people of color move in. That's what it means in real estate. I wonder how that term came to be.
That is an excellent question.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it until just now.
Yeah, so, I have no idea. Daily Variety.
There you go. All right, we will look it up. We will look it up and figure it out for next time. But it's interesting that you know, all the movies sort of, there's the Christmas movies and then there's summer movies, and it's 4th of July weekend that all the summer movies come out. We're going to talk a little bit about the sort of the anti-blockbusters, right? So, Anne, I guess the AFI docs, the American Film Institute, documentaries were just screened. Was it last weekend?
Just last weekend, exactly. Yeah.
So tell folks about the importance of that particular gathering.
Well, you know, it comes at a at an important time in the year because summer, like you said, we have these blockbusters all summer, but resourceful and creative film people have found ways to kind of sneak in smaller movies for those audiences who don't necessarily want to go see Independence Day and Suicide Squad and all the rest. And documentaries are a big part of that counter-programming. So summer's kind of been an unofficial documentary season. You're going to see a lot of nonfiction movies arriving in theaters over the next couple of months, and many of them get their start over at AFI Docs, down at AFI Docs in Washington.
And it's interesting, Jed, I mean, I guess the number of movies that big Hollywood studios are producing each year has gone down somewhat exponentially, has it not? Over the last several years?
Yeah, it has. You know, it was in the hundreds. Well, going back to the 40s, I mean, they were making a movie a week, each studio. Now they're down to about 150 releases a year.
And that's down from like about, say, 400 or so not too long ago.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And they've just, you know, they've sort of, it's a pure corporate decision that, you know, they have these great big machines to market movies worldwide. And nobody else does. And so they're concentrating on movies that are great big machines and can be marketed that way. Totally rational. It leaves all the rest of it, the documentaries and smaller independent films, which is the growing part of the film world in terms of what's being created, to other people.
Yeah.
And the audience is totally curious about all of that, the studio movies, but certainly the documentaries and the smaller independent narratives. And as Anne said, I mean, the growth of the documentary-only festival has been fascinating. Since we started, AFI Docs has come on stream. There's a wonderful festival in Missouri called True False, run by filmmakers, affiliated with a church that they've sort of brought in. I mean, they're really incredible. Full Frame in Durham, now affiliated with Duke University, and then Hot Docs in Toronto, and there are a few others, Rotterdam, there are a few others worldwide, but it's fascinating.
And of course, the Maryland Film Festival, which you just had a big success with just last month, always has a very healthy dose of docs, plus, you know, fiction films, and you guys have done that forever. And I guess most film festivals now, I mean, Sundance and New York, Tribeca, and all that, they have a mix of docs and narrative fiction.
Yeah, I would say Sundance was really a pioneer in honoring docs and giving them, I mean, they really started with narrative and doc competitions, and that was unusual then in the film festival world.
Yeah. Well, I'm always excited to see you guys, but I am extra excited this morning because I have not only seen one, I have seen two movies that we can actually talk about.
Oh my God, this is a banner day!
So, exactly. So
I'm going to light two sparklers this weekend.
Two sparklers. I guess longtime listeners to the program know that I live a completely pathetic life and I never go out. But I have seen not one but two movies that we can actually legitimately talk about in terms of alternative programming to Blockbuster. So I'm very excited. So let me just casually mention. The movie about Norman Lear, which I saw at the Maryland Film Festival. This was a great doc and a great, I forget the title of it actually, I don't have it written
just
down.
Just Another Version of You.
Just Another Version of You. Of course, Norman Lear, the great television pioneer. But Anne, his impact on social, the culture of the United States of America cannot be understated.
Exactly. And it was, that was the closing night film of AFI Docs on Sunday night. So the audience had the supreme pleasure of seeing the man in full, you know, and he is at 94 years of age, an absolute wonder, both in terms of his physical condition and mental, and his mental condition, curiosity and verve. And you're right. I mean, the documentary really does, I think, kind of pay homage and appropriately elevate him to his proper place in our cultural history. And there's a scene in the movie where Amy Poehler is paying tribute to him, where she makes a joke, but that, you know, that kind of socially aware satire. I mean, we had sitcoms before, but not satires. I mean, satire is a completely different genre.
So All in the Family.
Exactly. And All in the Family being, that's the big breakthrough.
I mean, these are some of the big shows that he
did. Exactly. Yeah. And Good Times and the Jeffersons. But you know, there really aren't that many mainstream comedies that are doing that kind of cultural work today.
Yeah.
And you have to remember he had 7 primetime shows on. I mean, it's unheard of. And this is
at the same time.
Yeah. This is a time when, you know, a hit show like All in the Family, one of his shows, would draw 23 million households every week to the screen. And the whole idea...
And now those are kind of like Super Bowl numbers or something, right?
Exactly.
I mean, they're just a gigantic thing.
And he was, as Anne said, I mean, these things were very funny. They hold up really well. There are lots of clips in this film from some of these shows that are, you laugh out loud now. But they're about people who are very different with very different political and cultural views of the world. We didn't even know the word globalization then, but of that kind of, you know, acclimation of different kinds of people. And they're funny, and he makes fun of all kinds of people with all kinds of different views lovingly. And I think that's a huge difference. And you see families in All in the Family very much in love with each other and caring for each other with very different viewpoints on things. And so it's unusual in so many ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was such an important cultural force in the entertainment world and it in a way that isn't seen at all, not just in the numbers, but in the way he did it, too.
Here's a little clip from the documentary about Norman Lear.
Time for God's people to come out of the churches and change America.
I was concerned about what I was seeing on television, mixing politics and religion. So I thought, I want to take the flag back for all of us.
He called me and said, guess what? I own the Declaration of Independence.
Laughter, you know, just has to add time. You know, if lifting weights or running, you know, can add time. God, how laughter can add time. Remember, you heard it here.
Guys like us, we had it made. Guys were there.
Yeah, Archie Bunker, and there's some great stuff about All in the Family behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. You know, his conversations with Carol O'Connor about certain subjects, or a couple that Carol O'Connor didn't want to do.
Oh, yeah, they had a very contentious. I mean, that's not necessarily plumbed in the movie, but they had a really contentious relationship. And for me, one of the best, one of the most appealing conceits within the film is when some of the stars of those original shows are watching the clips and the filmmakers film them watching themselves and watching these. And not just, you know, so John Amos is watching a clip from Good Times, or Russell Simmons is, I mean, there's an amazing shot of Russell Simmons watching the Jeffersons. Yeah. And so you're getting that, you know.
He's the big hip-hop impresario.
Yeah, and you're getting that sense of just the watershed nature of these conversations that these shows were opening up, how powerful they still are.
Anne Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the executive director of the Maryland Film Festival. It's the monthly Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us today. We're talking movies for this 4th of July weekend. I mean, it's really a really great inside look into Norman Lear. So as I said, I have seen it.
Well done, sir.
I have nothing intelligent to say about
well
it, but I would
you.
Just like to say I really enjoyed it.
Good.
I laughed, I cried.
Yes. You know,
it was great. So.
And that'll be out in a few weeks.
Yeah.
Yes, and then it'll be on American Masters later on.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So plenty of ways to see it.
Yep.
There's one, Jed, that you've seen, a movie called Kate Plays Christine.
Yeah.
This wasn't at AFI, but it's an interesting doc. What's this one about?
Yes, this is a documentary about an actress preparing to play a role that eventually never gets filmed, and I'm not sure it was ever intended to be filmed, but the role is a woman who was a reporter on a small station in Sarasota, Florida, and in 1974 shot herself and killed herself on the air. And the actress, Caitlin Scheel, who's been in House of Cards and a lot of independent films, you see this whole process of her preparing that scene, the public on air scene of killing herself. And it's a fascinating story and exploration of the artistic process, but also as you're watching it, you're sucked in to this what do you want to see? You know, and I think this is a very crucial thing in our culture. You know, it's a horrifying thing. You know, it's a horrifying thing. And as they're preparing to create that scene, the actress and the crew, I think all the way through, you've got to be sort of saying, do I want them to do this or not?
Decisions have to be made in movies.
Yeah. And nobody's going to get hurt. I mean, it's not because anything real is going to happen. But should the audience see it? Should I see it? Do I want to see it? Mm-hmm. And so it works on so many levels.
Really great, interesting questions.
Yeah.
I want to keep moving through some of these titles because we have so much to talk about. And there's a movie called Life Animated. Mm-hmm. There's a local connection to this movie, a guy named Roger Ross Williams, who also did music by Prudence. He's affiliated with Mica, I guess. Is that right, Jen?
That film was, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So Life Animated, what's this one about?
Yeah, this also played at AFI Docs last weekend, and it's the story of a young man named Owen Suskind, who, when he was 3 years old, was diagnosed with autism and really closed off from his family, stopped communicating, stopped talking, kind of went into his own world and very isolated, and the family couldn't get to him. And the one thing that he loved in life were Disney cartoons and was transfixed by those. And one day his father, Ron, who's a really well-known journalist and author, happened to pick up a puppet of Iago, the little parrot from the Aladdin movie, and started speaking with Owen in the parrot voice, and Owen started talking, and this whole family discovered that their way in to this boy and his way out to them was through Disney cartoons. So it's a film just about that journey, and about this extraordinary young man who, like Norman Lear, showed up at the Q&A and was the star of the show. He was at the Maryland Festival too. Wasn't he?
His brother Walter was
there.
Oh,
good.
Yeah, Owen couldn't come, but Walt was there, and, mm-hmm. and Roger was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's another movie I want to mention briefly. It's no longer at the Charles, but it's on demand, which I actually saw as well. It's Wiener. It's about Anthony Wiener and his campaign for mayor after the revelations of his, you know, sexting came out. So what's fascinating about it is the incredible access that these filmmakers had. I mean, there are places in that movie you just cringe thinking that he's in a room and there's people with a camera pointed towards him. I mean, how do documentarians get this? I mean, the relationship between the filmmaker and their subjects is incredibly intimate.
Well, I think it's a skill a really good documentary filmmakers have, which is to get their subjects to trust them. And they earn it. I mean, that's not a trick. They earn it. In this case, I think the main subject, Congressman Wiener, has an appetite for attention that the film shows you, that I think all politicians have it to some degree, right? Or you don't become a politician. Same for actors. And this is an extreme version of that appetite. And I think what the insight of that you get through this film without, I mean, it's not exposition. I mean, it's not like anybody talks to you about it. It's just you see it, you're watching it. And in contrast to his wife, Huma Abedin, who is the opposite.
I mean, obviously, a close confidant and aide to Hillary Clinton
mm-hmm, and, since she was Secretary of State and working with her on the campaign. And her, I mean, she's clearly fascinated by people with this appetite for attention and, you know, to use it. But she's a completely different personality. She's very private. She's you couldn't have cast this movie better. And I think the access question is a really good one. And I don't think to this day we have a complete answer of why they went through.
We do. No, it was co-directed by a guy named Josh Kriegman who worked for Wiener in Congress. So he was a staffer. I mean, it's not like he.
So they knew each other. Yeah,
but, and honestly, I think that should have been disclosed in the film.
Oh well, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, because you know, I think all the viewers of the film have that question, I just feel like it wouldn't have taken anything away from the experience of that movie for him to have come clean about that.
I agree, but that only explains the beginning. You know, that opens the door the first time. Why is the camera left in the room so often? You know, and that I think has more to do with
Narcissism.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And of course, you know, Lord knows how much he shot and what they didn't put in the movie. I mean, the filmmaker who made the Norman Lear movie, a woman who's actually has a couple of Baltimore connections, and I'm blanking on her name.
Rachel. And Rachel Grady.
Yeah.
And Rachel's on our board.
And they said that they shot, you know, hundreds of hours of stuff, and it's a two-hour movie, you know, two-and-a-half-hour movie, so who knows. All right, well, we will continue this discussion when we come back after a break for the news. Ann Hornaday, Jed Dietz, thanks for being here. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Before we come back and talk more about antidotes to summer blockbusters, we're going to hear a Baltimore story from our good friend, Gil Sandler.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. First Friday of the month means we talk movies with our movie mavens, Ann Hornaday, the award-winning film critic for The Washington Post, and Jed Dietz, the executive director of the Maryland Film Festival. We're talking about documentaries and some movies that are sort of counter-programmed to all these summer blockbusters for all the folks who have inclinations to see Independence Day or Star Trek or something like that. We've got some other suggestions for you as well this morning. Jed, I want to talk about another documentary about a huckster doctor, a guy named Dr. Brinkley, and the movie is called Nuts. This character sounds wild.
So this is a guy who grew up in Kansas. He announced that he had a cure for impotence, which had to do with placing goat testicles inside the patient. And he built this into a huge business. He made himself very wealthy. He owned a large radio station at one point. He ran for governor of Kansas at one point. And it's, again, a part of our culture. I'd never heard of this guy before I saw the movie, that is in our culture, right? I mean, we're susceptible.
What's the time period that this guy was in his heyday?
Early part of the 20th century.
It was 20s and 30s.
He died in 36, yeah.
It is amazing to think that anybody could sort of fall for that. You know, most of the scams you hear about now are sort of financial. They're not medical
or
like
political.
This. Or political. Yeah. But it's really quite something. But so a documentary about a guy who died in 1936, that's a different kettle of fish, isn't it, than, you know, doing a documentary about Anthony Weiner.
But the same sort of elements, because he had an unquestioned belief in this, or said he had this belief in it. You don't know what's in his head, I guess. But and then you see him parlay it into bigger and better things. And he was sort of insightful. I mean, this radio station thing that he created really changed broadcasting, radio broadcasting at the time. And so he was this odd mix, as I think charlatans often are, of very bright, very charismatic, with some kernel of truth in it, and then maybe doing some good in some fields too.
Yeah, I mean, Ann is, you know, obviously the standard bearer for the Republican Party has been accused of being a carnival barker, a huckster. Mm-hmm. Is this kind of movie sort of relevant and resonating now because of this particular moment that we're in the American political process?
Definitely. And the filmmaker Penny Lane, her most recent film was a movie called Our Nixon, which was a fascinating film that was constructed from the home movies that Nixon's colleagues in the White House were taking, just because they were so excited to be there and they all had new cameras. It was these little 8mm.
Coulson and those guys. They were
I can't remember the aides' names right now, but it's just beautiful footage. And so she put it together in a kind of a witty way, actually. And I think at one point he talks about All in the Family in that movie and criticizes that. But so she has that same sort of whimsical eye in this film, which is completely animated. There are some live action talking heads. She talks to historians and biographers and stuff like that. So, no, there's no question that the filmmakers are interested in making connections with our present day culture.
There's a movie, Anne, that's opening tonight at the Charles. It's called Tickled. What's that one about?
Yes. This is a movie about a journalist in New Zealand who's sort of a human interest pop culture reporter for his television station, very engaging, charismatic guy, who happens upon a video of young men engaging in quote-unquote competitive endurance tickling. And it's just so bizarre and weird that
who knew?
You know, there's something for everyone in this world of ours.
Guess.
Nothing new under the sun. So he wants to follow up and do a story because it looks like a fun story. And he quickly, when he starts to, you know, get to the people who produced the video and put it up, he experiences this very vicious, paranoid pushback from a woman named Jane O'Brien, who apparently is the producer of these videos. And so then his quest begins to be, why this reaction from her? Who is she? What's going on? So Tickled goes from being what it's, you know, you think it's going to be kind of this human side of a fetish community. And it instead goes really into this very dark, dark, disquieting territory of exploitation, abuse of power, probably criminality. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but it becomes a really disturbing portrait and a kind of an investigative mystery story.
Mm. Competitive tickling.
Yeah, so, the dark side.
Is there a light side to competitive tickling?
I mean, to his credit,
I mean, obviously
he does
people
find...
chuckle when they get tickled, but I mean...
Yeah, well, there's no question that it's, you know, that it has issues of dominance and submission and all. You know, it's a part of that world. But he does find a person who's not, quote-unquote, a bad guy.
Right.
You know, he does find that sort of human side of that community, but it really becomes much more about a particular individual that is... up to no good.
Yeah. I've heard so much about it, I can't wait to see it. Mm.
Let me casually mention another title of a movie that I've actually seen.
Oh!
Because I just, you know, sorry, this is actually the third one. You know?
Now you're just showing off.
I am, because I have not seen three movies in the last 10 years of this program, but I have seen three since we last talked. And this is a movie called Dipan. It's about Sri Lankan refugees who end up in Paris, and chaos ensues. But this is a charming movie, I thought, and a very profound movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and here we are a week past Brexit, and you know, immigration being a key issue there. And this is the other point of view. This is the refugee and what you go through. And then your effort to just fit in to this new culture, in this case, a public housing unit outside of Paris, it ends up in a way that the ending I wasn't wild about, but I think it's an incredible portrait. I think the three leads are phenomenal.
Yeah, and given the Brexit vote, this tells the story from the point of view of the immigrant.
Absolutely.
And of course, this won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and you were there to see it there.
It did. I mean, it's by Jacques Audiard, who's probably still best known for his movie A Prophet, which was just a truly extraordinary, you know, just a masterful film. I wouldn't put this up in that class. I didn't think it deserved the Palme d'Or. I felt that Son of Saul deserved the Palme d'Or last year. But that, and I totally agree with Jed. It goes into this kind of genre territory that is
jarring.
It is jarring, yes.
Yeah, no, it is.
And felt, exactly. It's just not, it doesn't match up. But, you know, with these people that we meet and the kind of, what's fascinating about the story and the characters is that they're kind of thrown together in this improvised family. I mean, they're not related. They pretend to be related in order to get refugee status, and it's just, so it has that other
thing,
layer
it's
of.
It's fascinating all sorts
it is.
Of levels. Okay, always fun to talk to you guys. Happy 4th of July.
Thank you.
And
you too.
Look forward to seeing you next month.
Happy 4th.
Sparklers, everybody.
Sparklers, everybody. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Hornaday from the Washington Post. We've got a link to some of the movies we've talked about on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Shane Raphael is our intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday on a special 4th of July edition of Maryland Morning, a conversation with the leaders of Baltimore's Promise. It's an organization that brings together civic leaders to tackle the problems facing kids in Charm City, plus a book that suggests good reads for kids who are early and eager readers. That's all on the way Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great holiday weekend.